Okay, let me ask, any questions from before the break? Do we have any questions from before the break? Yeah, Mr. King.
It sounds like a big scam. The pour some money into the system and causing inflation, and you said it's to the benefit of the stockholders.
Well, it operates to their benefit relative to the bondholders, but they too can end up losing, as I hope to be able to show.
Well, who are the biggest winners of this whole system? I mean, why would the government keep doing this?
Okay, good question. Why do they do it? And that brings us to the next set of questions. The deeper roots of inflation, why does it go on? And what are the motives for it? And then also the further effects. Now notice, if you think of inflation just as rising prices, well, that's it. There's no way to even ask what are the deeper roots, what are the further effects. But when you think of inflation in terms of the increase in the quantity of money, then it's possible to ask these questions. All right, so why do we have inflation? Well, there's a variety of motives. One leading one, the first point under G, is to foster the view of the government as Santa Claus. When the government has the ability to create money, people gain the conviction that the government can give them free benefits. And people look to the government to support them. Now this, in fact, is one of the most serious consequences of having abandoned the gold standard. See, when gold is money, whatever gold the government may possess, it spends, right? The money, I think I've made the point earlier in the term, money comes to goods, money comes to goods. So whatever money is in the hands of the government, it's spending, and that money is going to the producers of goods. Okay, where then must the government turn for fresh money? It's a consumer. Its expenditures don't support themselves. So where does the government have to go, at least under a gold standard? To the citizens. Now let me address the question to the gold mines. Some people think, well, why don't they get more money by mining more gold? Well, today, yes, you wanted to say something? It's very costly. Today, the price of gold has been fluctuating between 400 and not quite 450. There are additional sources of gold. Why aren't all possible sources of gold exploited? It's not profitable because there are potential sources of gold out there that would cost $500 an ounce to extract. There are others that might require $1,000 or $2,000. So at the present price of gold, those sources just don't pay. All of the sources that do pay are being exploited. Now, if the government needed more money and the only way it could get it was through mining additional gold, would the government gain anything by mining gold, by mining an ounce of gold at a cost of an ounce and a half of gold? No. So they can't regard gold mining as a source of gold. So where does the government have to turn for its money? To the citizens. So under a gold standard, it becomes very clear that the government is financially dependent on the citizens. The citizens are the people who always have the money, because whatever money the government has, it's spending, then it's in the hands of the citizens. And to continue its expenditure, the government has to keep returning to the citizens to get fresh funds. Now, you might think, well, couldn't they borrow money? Could they operate with budget deficits? Well, they certainly do that today. The government has a huge and growing budget deficit. It's had a budget deficit in all but a handful of years since 1933. So what allows the government every year to run at a budget deficit? What would happen if you and I were running at a major deficit relative to our incomes, and this tended to actually increase as time went on?
Bankruptcy.
We'd end up in bankruptcy. There are limits to how much debt we can service with a limited income. Now, why doesn't the government have that problem? Yes, Mr. Gaines. Well, they might increase the allowance, but you or I could increase our own allowance. So I'll say, okay, I'm allowing myself to run up $500,000 of debt. Well, and that doesn't mean anyone would lend me that much. And if they did, how would I ever handle it?
You'd go into debt more because you have...
What happens
to
people? When people get too deep into debt, what happens?
File bankruptcy.
They end up having to go bankrupt. They just lack the means of servicing the debt. It's too big for them. Well, why doesn't that happen to the United States government?
They can make money.
Because they can print money. They have the ability to print money. Now, if you and I had that ability, we would never go bankrupt either, so long as what we owed was the money that we could print. So what allows the government to operate with budget deficits is the fact that it has the ability to create money. That's the two are essentially connected. Now, suppose the government did not have the ability to create money. It only has that ability because the money is this irredeemable paper. All they need is the paper and the presses, and they don't even need that today. They just need some hard drives and keyboards, and they can type in billions of dollars of new money. But suppose the monetary unit were a physical quantity of gold. Imagine the monetary unit were 1 ounce of gold, or a dollar is defined as some part of an ounce. Until 1933, the dollar was defined as approximately 1/20th of an ounce of a certain fineness. I'd imagine we had a similar definition of a dollar, and so the only way there could be more dollars was to the extent there would be more gold. And now imagine that the government runs at a deficit in those circumstances. Well, then what happens?
The value of the money goes down.
Well, its debt increases. Are they in a position to get more money to service the debt? What do they have to do to get more money?
They can make better environment.
Well, today they can print it, but I'm asking you...
They couldn't. You have to go to the people. Taxes.
They would have to turn to taxes. And if they're building up the debt, their reason for going into debt in the first place is they wanted to avoid asking for taxes. But they really can't do that for very long, because if the debt mounts, the interest burden increases. And what happens as anybody's debt starts getting large to his source of being able to pay the debt? What happens to your prospects for borrowing if you have a limited income and you already walk in with a substantial debt? You're a poorer credit risk, so you may not be able to borrow at all. And if you can borrow, it'll be at a higher interest rate. And the same thing certainly applies to private companies. What determines the interest rate a company pays is partly how much debt it already has, how sound are its earnings, how big is the debt relative to its reasonable earnings prospects. And to the extent that a company has bigger debt and lesser earnings prospects, it may find it just can't borrow, or if it does borrow, it has to be at a very high interest rate. Well, that same set of principles would apply to the government. And so if it ran at deficits and the debt mounts, it would find the interest rate it had to pay would rise, the credit rating of its securities would go down, and the day would come when the government has debts coming due to repay, and it finds it can't borrow any fresh money. Well, at that point, what would be the outcome?
The government would be bankrupt.
Now, under a gold standard, the government would know and did know that if it pursued a policy of deficits, if it were really going to run at deficits and attempt to do this over any length of time, it would know that it would ultimately be faced with bankruptcy. Now, unless the government is insane, it doesn't want that to happen. So what must it do to avoid that happening? No, but it doesn't have the power to create money. Assume it doesn't have the power to create money.
Then it has to borrow from the people.
Pardon me?
You either borrow from the people or...
But it knows that if it borrows from the people, if it thinks of that as a regular prospect, it's going to go bankrupt. It doesn't want to go bankrupt. It can't manufacture money. So what must it do, given that it can't manufacture money and wants to avoid any possibility of ever going down the road toward bankruptcy? You can say...
Make the government smaller.
What must it do in terms of the relationship between the money it can take in taxes and the money it's spending? It has to equalize. What is the equality between tax revenues and government expenditures called? A balanced budget means that all of the government's expenditures are covered out of current tax revenues. All of its current expenditures, all of the expenditures it will make in a fiscal year are covered by taxes being collected in that very same fiscal year. That's a balanced budget. Now, if the government has a balanced budget, that means it doesn't add any debt over the year. It does not incur any new additional debt over the year. So if the government operated with a balanced budget, it would not have a mounting debt. It could conceivably have no debt, and it would never be threatened with the prospect of bankruptcy. A government's inability to create money and its knowledge that if it borrows, it's going to be headed down the road toward bankruptcy would force on the government a policy of balanced budgets. The government would be compelled, unless it were utterly reckless, to balance its budget. Now, this would have huge implications for the size of the government, what it could undertake. Just think, if the government were under the necessity, simply by virtue of where is it going to get the money? See, if the government can't manufacture the money, then it has to turn to the citizens for the money, and the citizens don't want to pay higher taxes. There's a lot of opposition to higher taxes. So here's the government. It's entertaining proposals for new spending programs. And there are people saying, well, we need this new program to serve this, that, and the other need. Okay, what question has to be raised immediately every time you're considering some new spending proposal if the government has to have a balanced budget?
You have to say, what do you cut?
It has to say, what other programs do we equivalently cut if we're going to add this one? Or how do we wring additional taxes out of the public? All right, well, what do you think the effect of that set of circumstances would be on the government's ability to get new and additional spending programs approved? Would it be extremely difficult? Let's take the latest major spending initiative, the president's prescription drug benefit program, which is scheduled to add hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade. Now, suppose the government could not print money and it is simply not in a position to add additional hundreds of billions of dollars to its debt. And now this proposal is raised. What do you think would happen to it? It would be rejected. It probably wouldn't even be raised in the first place in the knowledge that it was certain to be rejected. See, if you're proposing that new hundreds of billions be spent, the question is, where does the money come from? Where is the money coming from? We have to get the money from somewhere. We can't create the money. We have to obtain it, and it's worse than pulling teeth to get it. So if we don't try to pull more teeth, we have to cut other spending. So something like this would never get off the ground. A huge portion of what the government is doing would never have been done in the first place. But when the government has the ability to create money, it is then not necessary that it operate with a balanced budget. It can borrow money, because part of what it's borrowing is not really borrowing from the people, it's borrowing from its own bank, which is manufacturing the money. And to the extent that the government does borrow from the people, and it should run into any kind of difficulty, suppose it's faced with higher interest rates, is that a problem so long as the government is in a position to manufacture the money it needs to repay? So you just think, suppose you had a license to print dollars. How would that affect your budget? There you are. It's legal for you to manufacture dollars.
That would increase my budget.
Okay. Yeah. Would there be any reason? Would you have any reason to curtail your spending?
No.
Not really.
No.
Shoes.
Suppose, buddy.
Lots of shoes.
Now you might. Let's say we're getting close to New Year's Eve. You might say, I've been spending too much this year. It's not right. Next year I'm having a balanced budget. I promise I'm going to be a good boy next year.
And I'm
having
a Christmas.
Right. Okay, now what happens 1 week after the new year? You see something that
something
you think
important.
You have to have? You break the resolution. These balanced budget resolutions are no better than dieters' resolutions. There's nothing that compels adhering to them. There's no reason why you have to. You have the ability easily to get away with it. There are all kinds of things the government wants to spend money on, and people want the government to spend money on. It's filled with temptations. It has the means, so there's no real constraint. But if the government could not create money, if it didn't have that power, then it would be dependent on the citizens. It could not simply take on new spending obligations, because it would have to raise taxes or cut other programs. So a major effect of the government's ability to create money is a huge expansion in the size of the government. Because people view government spending as essentially costless. Here we are, people, the government is free to entertain spending proposals, and there is no close tie to taxes. The president can talk about his prescription drug benefit, and no one is raising the question, where do we find the additional tax money from this year? They don't have to raise that question. Why not?
Because
the government can borrow the money, and it can go on borrowing, because the Federal Reserve is in there creating new and additional money. Now, this brings about a total reversal of the proper relationship between the government and the citizens. See, in a free country, the government is supposed to be the servant of the people. The people are supposed to be sovereign, and the government is supposed to be their servant. Well, that requires that the government be financially dependent on the people. The people have to control the money, and the government has to be beholden to the people for its money. But since we've abandoned the gold standard, the government has become financially independent of the citizens. It doesn't have to get all of its money from the citizens. It has its own personal source of funds, its own special source of funds, and that is its own printing press. So the government has the means of getting money, that it can obtain money that doesn't have to come from the citizens, that it creates and spends. And the result is that people, instead of recognizing that the government is financially dependent on them and a burden on them, they believe that they are dependent on the government. Because the government is actually where they do get money from. The government creates money, the people are getting money from the government, and they look to the government as supporting them. Now, the whole population of the country can think that the government supports them. The government is in a position to give everybody money, because they manufacture it. And so people think, oh, the government, that's this being sitting on top of Mount Olympus, and we're all beholden to it. It's the master, we're the servants. Well, you see, the overthrow of the gold standard has brought this about. With the gold standard, we know the government is dependent, the people are sovereign, but today it's really the government that's sovereign, the people are dependent. Now, why? How do we get into such a situation? Well, there are a lot of people around who already had the idea the government is Santa Claus. Their basic view of the government is that it's a kind of omnipotent divine being. They think of the government as all-powerful and all-good. And to be able to maintain that view requires that the government have its own ability to spend, its own source of funds. Yes, Ms. Bonanno.
So, the government's ability to manufacture money.
Yeah.
Which usually when you have create the demand and the supply of money,
yeah,
will create inflation,
mm-hmm,
usually in a more positive way, because prices will go up when there's that demand there,
yeah,
with the infusion of the supply of money.
Yeah.
But when the government is providing the supply of money, but it's not necessarily, the demand is not there, so the prices go up without really a true demand at times.
Well, the effect of the government's creation of money is to make prices rise.
Even now, without demand.
Well,
because see, you could have demand for something, so the prices will increase the prices when there's the demand goes up, prices go up. So now we've got prices going up without real demand there.
Additional money will raise demand in terms of money. It'll tend to raise all demands. Now, a student raised the question, used the expression scam a little while ago. I think that was you, Mr. Kane, right?
Putting a check
by your name. Yeah, well, Mr. Kane raised the question of a scam, but actually the scam, I think, is much larger than you might have thought. Here's the government. It is the source of funds, and people think they're getting free benefits from the government, because it appears that the government can give us things. We'll get free prescription drugs. Tens of millions of people will get free prescription drugs, or greatly reduced cost prescription drugs. And there's no question of who's going to pay for this. Well, the government is giving us all this. The government is giving us our old age pensions. The government is reindustrializing the Midwest, or might do that. The government is doing one wonderful thing after another. Now, to the extent it does this on the foundation of newly created money, what is the effect on prices?
Increases.
They go up. And now, when people see the rise in prices, they think, yeah, that's inflation. Inflation is rising prices. Well, who raises the prices?
Business people.
Business people raise the prices. They're responsible for inflation. Here we are, we have the government. What a wonderful thing that is. It's giving us all the free teeth in Britain or whatever. It's giving us one wonderful free benefit after another. That's just marvelous. And then we have this inexplicable evil. There are these terrible, vicious, capitalist pig businessmen. They're raising prices. They're creating inflation. The government is giving us free benefits. The capitalist pigs are giving us inflation. And this is how it stands in the minds of economically ignorant people. And then they think, well boy, we need to summon this wonderful government that's given us all these wonderful free things, and we need to have it sit on the heads of these vicious businessmen who are giving us the inflation. And I think that's how matters stand in the minds of a majority of people. Yes, Mr. Alekis.
Do you think that is mainly due? Do you think the United States government is able to do this because the American dollar is quote unquote comparatively strong to the rest of the world's economy? And if so, do you see other countries that perhaps the one world money system that has been kind of talked about for the last 10 years or whatever, do you see that as maybe eventually bringing it into what the government's control is over our own money, or at least devaluing it a little bit?
I think you have a number of questions here. One is, has the U.S. government been able to pursue this policy because the dollar is stronger than most other currencies? Well, it's only stronger to the extent that we've done it less, we've done this sort of thing less than most other countries. So to the extent that we start doing it more rapidly and more rapidly than other countries, then that serves to jeopardize the international status of the dollar. And that may be going on now. In 2000, for example, the euro was as low as, I think, 84 cents or something like that. And what is the euro currently?
$1.30.
On the order of $1.30, maybe. So this is a huge rise. And this is the result of the fact that we've swung from a brief period of budget surpluses into budget deficits, and the Federal Reserve brought down the federal funds rate from maybe 5% or 6%, wherever it was, all the way down to 1% and held it there for quite a while. And to do this, it had to create money more rapidly. And so this has served to cause the dollar to fall against the euro. And if this is kept up much longer, if there should be a move around the world where foreign governments decide they don't want to hold the dollars or not hold them as extensively, and they prefer to hold something else, whether it's the euro or possibly gold, then if they unload their dollars, where must those dollars end up?
Back here.
Back here.
Back here.
And that would mean there'd be a very considerable increase in the supply of dollars that would have to circulate in the U.S., and then we'd experience a more rapid growth in spending and rise in prices. Yes, Ms. Buckles.
Personally, I don't feel the government's really done that much for me or given me anything free. I want to know who's getting the free stuff, because I want stuff, you know? And it seems like to me is that it's basically the middle-class working people who are affected the most by everything that the government does. It's our taxes, and yet they're giving it to I don't know who.
Well, I think about half of federal government spending goes to finance Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid. Then there are substantial subsidies to different groups. There are all kinds of off-the-books programs where the government has loan guarantees. I'm sure if you search online, you could get a copy of the federal budget in brief for the current year, and you get some idea of how the expenditure is broken down. I think the federal government is spending currently roughly $2.5 trillion. And, of course, a few hundred billions are going for the armed forces and the war in Iraq. That's been something added. Yes, Mr. Sadowski.
All other countries basically run off the same kind of standard? Like, do their governments print money, or do they run off of, like, gold standards?
No, their governments print money, too, and almost all of them have been printing it more rapidly than the United States government. The reason the dollar is better than almost all other currencies, or has been, is because we've pursued these policies to a lesser extent than other countries.
What about the euro?
The euro. Okay, well.
Like, how do they print money?
Their mechanism is essentially the same as ours, and they create new and additional money too, but the euro has only been in existence since 1999. And it remains to be seen. They have deficits also. One of the conditions of belonging to the Eurozone was that a country's deficit was supposed to be less than, I believe, 3% of its GDP. But France and Germany, the two biggest countries, have been violating that for several years, and they're able to get away with it. We'll see what happens with the euro. I mean, they're in a very difficult position. In Germany, the unemployment rate is 12.5%, and in France, it's something over 10%. In both countries, they have vastly more powerful labor unions than we do. And so there is very little chance of getting them to relax their wage rate demands. And at the same time, this great clamor to reduce unemployment. Well, what's the classic mechanism that's adopted to reduce unemployment?
Government
hiring. Pardon me?
Government jobs.
Well, other than direct government employment, stimulating the economy with by means of more money, infusing more money. And I would think France and Germany at the present juncture are probably eager to do that. And you can already read there's some dissatisfaction with how the European Union is working out. People were expecting that it would bring prosperity, but here they have this persistent mass unemployment. So I think it's very possible, suppose the European Central Bank doesn't want to accommodate the more rapid expansion. Well, then I think in a few years, maybe it'll lead to the breakup of the European Union. And if they want to avoid the breakup, then maybe they'll start creating money more rapidly. Yes, Mr. L.
Since you're on a different topic than really the notes, I was wondering, is China, I read an article regarding China and India the other day about their economies and how they will probably supersede the American economy and probably in the next 5 years or so. And so I was wondering what your take was on that. Do you see that China can become stronger economically that way? I mean, they have a huge workforce.
Yeah.
They have the ability.
I've read projections. I haven't seen anything claiming 5 years, but supposedly maybe in 15 years in one category after another, they'll supposedly be surpassing us. Doesn't mean that it will automatically happen. I mean, if they were to continue growing at the same rate they have been growing, and if all of the growth is genuine, then that would happen.
Is that because they're also investing more into
They have a tremendous investment rate. I was surprised to read that if you think in terms of net investment, not the gross basis that we've been doing it on, but supposedly roughly half of their GDP comes from investment, which is a staggering proportion.
The reason that the timeline was different, or the logic on that, was because people will become really dissatisfied with the U.S. dollar and start to get out of that, which will kind of make that whole thing happen faster.
Well, I don't think there'd be a rush to switch to the Chinese money. The Chinese money is pegged to the U.S. dollar, and we're complaining about that.
There was some other logic in there in terms of that, you know, money would run out of the country instead, or run into the country.
Yeah, well, the Chinese central bank holds a vast amount of dollars, as does the Japanese central bank. And if they became disenchanted with the dollar and wanted to reduce their holdings, the only place for those dollars to end up would be here in the United States.
And so,
it would mean a great reduction in the demand for dollars for holding that would serve to sharply raise the velocity of the dollar.
Right, and so India was part of that whole.
Now, I don't know to what extent India holds dollars. I'm sure they hold some, but they're not usually mentioned as among the major dollar holders.
Right.
But China and Japan are.
I guess people were going to run to India. Where would they go?
Well, I don't think they'll run to the Indian money or the Chinese money. They would probably run to the euro and the yen first, and if they don't want to run to those, then I think they'd have to run to gold. Okay, so just consider the ability of the government to have its own money, its own source of money, means that government programs appear in a very, very different light to people, proposed government programs, because there is no strong connection between the spending for the programs and the cost to the citizens. See, if the government had to have a balanced budget each year, then each new program would have to be accompanied by equivalent proposals for taxes or reductions in other programs. People would never be able to think of a government programs simply in terms of its benefits. But the way things have stood since we overthrew the gold standard, since we abandoned the gold standard, is that the advocates of a new government program are able to enumerate its benefits. And they don't have to be concerned about the cost. The government doesn't have to have equivalent revenues to pay for the program at any given time. And because it doesn't have to have that, people feel that they can just talk about the benefits. So imagine we're discussing government-supported child care centers. Okay, you'd find the supporters of the child care centers describing how difficult it is to be a working mother and how much working mothers would be benefited by the child care centers. And that's what people hear. And then there are some people, perhaps, who are opposed to the government financing this. But then what is projected as the source of their opposition?
They don't like working mothers.
They don't like working mothers. They're enemies of humanity. They're nasty old Scrooges. They're against what's good for the people, what the people need and want. These characters are inexplicably opposed. Now, isn't that how the opposition between liberals and conservatives is made to appear again and again? Here are the liberals. They want to be benefactors of mankind. They want to do so much good for so many people, and this is how they'll do it. And here, there's inexplicable opposition. Why would anybody be against working mothers having their lives easier? Well, if that were the only issue, if the only issue were working mothers get child care centers and it really costs nobody anything, well, why would anyone be against that? But the reality is it does cost somebody the amount of the program, but we don't have a close, tight connection because the government isn't compelled to operate with a balanced budget. So they can add on the spending, and then they'll worry about the finances next year or 5 years later or never. And they don't have to worry about the mounting debt because they can just keep printing money to finance the debt when it comes due.
But isn't it the people, though, or because the creation of the money does cause inflation, because you've got a supply, you're creating money, you're creating supply, which is creating inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as the worker is saying, hey, my wages are in line, or at least in line with inflation, so I'm going to accept it because it's giving me a benefit, even though it is in creating inflation, I can afford it better than if I had to just pay for that service myself.
Well, there might be some people who can take that point of view, but there are many, many others who, when they're faced with rising prices, what happens to them?
Well, they stop spending and they can't afford it. They go bankrupt.
Okay. Well, they're in great difficulty. Now, you see, though, how many people are even aware that what is making the prices rise is the government's financing of new and additional programs?
And the other thing is, you were saying, the most needy can be totally supported by the government. So.
I mean, well, some people may be, yes.
Well, many of them are, or a big portion of it is. So there's no reason for them to have to be more productive because they can't get out of that spiral. They can't earn more than the inflation and one of these other things. So they are going to be indebted to our government.
Yeah.
That everybody else is.
But you see, the government, the variability of the government to support this many people to that extent depends on the tie between government spending and taxes being broken. So the government can say, here we are, we have millions of needy people, we have to help them. And how can anyone oppose this? And the government is not obligated to say, we need a dollar of tax for every dollar we spend. So again and again, the issue appears one side wants to benefit some group, and it appears they can do this at no cost because they don't have to propose higher taxes right away. So this, I think the abandonment of the gold standard has led to the government becoming vastly larger than it would otherwise have been. If people had recognized that each step of the way, that each new program is going to add equivalent new taxes, much of this would never have gotten through. So an enormous consequence has been a great growth in the size of government. Yes, Mr. Kane.
Say in large, I mean, clearly that the moving from the gold-based currency is a major component of inflation, but also that the potency of the reserves changing, those requirements changing, is another reason as well, right?
Well, when you abandon the gold standard, reserves, you can create whatever reserves you need, and they also have become more potent, largely.
Further create causes of inflation.
Largely because it's known that you don't even need reserves. The government can manufacture whatever additional reserves might be required.
Okay.
See, if it was thought the government can't create reserves, and we have the reserves are thin, then there'd be huge pressure to build up the reserves.
Do you think, though, that had we not abandoned the gold standard, that even though we wouldn't have had the government's ability to create more money and of course, add to the inflation as a result of it, but if we had not abandoned the gold standard, do you believe that we still would have had the increase in technology and businesses and other things being able to create and sustain growth?
Do I believe had
I mean, we
not
would have, but to the same degree.
Do I believe that had we not abandoned the gold standard, we would have had the same degree of economic progress that we've had? I would think we would have had more,
really?
Because government spending would be a lot smaller. People would be in a position to save and invest relatively more. There'd be a lot less government regulation. We'd have much more economic freedom. People could innovate more. Improvements could be introduced more rapidly. I think we'd have a much more advanced economy.
I was thinking about that question because I took the MIS courses and they said internet was developed because the government wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, thinking about those like big projects, if government don't have enough funds, they probably won't have those projects. And the private company won't have those projects either because they cannot see them how far.
Okay. Now, Mr. Tsao says the government is responsible for having developed the internet and various other projects, which perhaps would not have been done by the private economy by itself.
Yeah.
All right. Another major government program that's often pointed to is the space program. It had lots of spin-off benefits and even World War II. All right. Now, one very important thing to keep in mind for starters is the fundamental lesson in Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, and that is do not focus simply on the seen. You also have to look at what is not seen, and we have to ask what would the various scientists and so on had been doing had they not been employed by the government. They would have been doing all kinds of other things. We don't even know precisely what, but they wouldn't have fallen asleep and done nothing. They'd have been making other contributions. So that's one very important point to keep in mind. And then secondly, to whatever extent anything is accomplished in government programs, like the space program and also with the internet, what is it that permits these things to work out ever to be a benefit to the citizens? Is it the government that looked at the civilian applications? Did the government say, all right, here's what we've accomplished in our space program, and now let's look at each one and figure out what use could we put these things to for the benefit of the civilian population?
The inefficiency in how they did it, the creative demand.
Who is responsible for whatever applications, for whatever civilian applications have come out of these things?
Private companies?
Private individuals and companies. They see, all right, here's something that's been accomplished in connection with government activity, and now let's put it to good use. And I would say the same thing with the internet. The government developed some kind of network I think to respond to atomic attacks or whatever. I believe this was the original core of the internet. Okay, and so we had some central cluster of network computers or whatever. But so that was the start, but what accounts for everything thereafter?
It's
all the different private firms. Do you think the government would have ever thought of, well, you know, why don't we put credit cards on the internet? I don't think something like that would never have happened. Or developing any of these other improvements. Now, it may be that some things would not have happened quite as fast, but I think fundamentally, you'll find the most rapid progress made in the freer the economy. See, look, suppose if we didn't have a free economy, if everything had been controlled by the government, do you think we would ever have gotten the automobile? When the automobile started, why did people buy the first automobiles?
Faster and
lower. Well, there really wasn't a very practical means of transportation. It was just an incredible object. Here's a horseless carriage. Isn't this incredible? Here's this thing that can propel itself. Doesn't need horses. So for quite a few years, it was a rich man's toy. Now, imagine if the government were in control of everything. Do you think they would make an appropriation for something that's just of amusement to a handful of rich people? I don't think so. And if the automobile had never been developed, do you think there would have been any possibility of developing the tank for military purposes? I would doubt it. So the countries that would be in a position to develop tanks would be those that were free enough to have automobiles. And then later, do you think radar would have been developed if there hadn't been a private economy developing radio? I wouldn't think so. Do you think the personal computer would have been developed at the initiative of the government?
That we would still have hand-to-hand combat?
What?
If we didn't develop the car and the radio?
Well, combat would have been at a much lower level, but the point I'm trying to make is that a free economy will have a much wider range of technological advancement, and it will lead, the freer the economy, the greater can be its military technology. When you have an economy whose focus is on military, is exclusively devoted to the military, it will not be undertaking the kind of broader research that a free economy undertakes.
You'd still be under Hitler's rule right about now.
Pardon me?
You said you'd still be under Hitler's rule right about now.
What do you mean?
Well, if it was left to government to develop those items.
Well, the reason that the United States was able to defeat Germany and Japan was the United States had the world's freest economy. It was the most powerful economy. And we were more advanced technologically. Now, as we become more and more controlled, our foundations of greater advance are undercut. But in the absence of a major private economy, we wouldn't have the automobile, but we wouldn't have the personal computer. You wouldn't have an internet. It's not, you see, most people are thinking, oh, the government starts the internet. They're not aware that without the private initiative, we wouldn't have personal computers. So the government might have some of its mainframe computers linked. That would have been the extent of the internet. Yes, Mr. Keane.
Well, I heard you saying, though, about the private industry to push the internet to, I don't know, applications that benefited the consumers, that we wouldn't have the internet, per se. But if we didn't have the internet that they developed, we wouldn't have private industry taking that initiative.
Well, that might be for some time, but we still have millions of personal computers, and the potential would be there. And I think it would have come along somewhat later. Suppose there had never been a government space program. I mean, already we'd have a private launching of satellites. Now, maybe that would have taken a generation longer.
But you said we advance faster.
Yeah, but we do fundamentally. Because before you can have a space program, you need to have an economy with a huge metallurgical industry, a huge electronics industry, and before that, you need an electrical industry. And so all of these preconditions are being developed, and so we can have them.
Would you agree that there's certain projects, let's just say, that require such a huge amount of capital that no private industry could ever come up with that?
That's certainly possible, which means that doesn't mean no private industry could ever do it, but they wouldn't do it as soon. And then when the government is doing it, and the government takes a big chunk of the resources of the private economy, well, they might accomplish certain limited objectives, but then you have to raise the question, what would have been done with the same resources had they been left in private hands? This is the issue of the seen and the unseen. What developments never came about. And then there's the further point, when the government does something, what is it that allows it to be of any private benefit? Well, it's because it's being done in the framework of an economy that's essentially still private. Okay, well, let's look at a few other related points. We can look at it here, or under the effects of inflation. Beyond the growth of government under the influence of inflation finance deficits and the free benefits idea, another major effect of the ability to expand the quantity of money by the government is a greater frequency and duration of wars. Just think, how do people view war as far as it relates to economic prosperity? I think it's very positive. Now, the only thing that makes it possible for people to believe that is that wars are typically financed by the creation of new and additional money. Imagine for a moment that the government could not create money even in war. So let's say here we are, we're going to get into a war, and the government is unable to create new and additional money. Well then, where must it obtain the money to finance the war?
Yep.
Where would it have to get the money to finance the war? It'd have to raise taxes. Well, imagine that a war is coming. How would that be perceived from an economic point of view? It would be perceived as, God help us, our taxes would be doubled or tripled. Pardon me?
It better be a good reason.
Yeah, there'd have to be a very good reason. The only time people might be willing to get involved in a war was when they thought the survival of the country was at stake. But anything less than that, they would perceive a war as a time of tremendous tax burdens, and they'd want to do everything possible to avoid it. But when the government has the power to pay for a war without having to raise taxes or raise them as high, then it's easier to gain support for the war, and there'll be less opposition. So this whole view that war is a source of prosperity, this feeds on the government's ability to pay for the war by the creation of new and additional money. Now, let's continue with these further effects of inflation. As I already explained in the last few weeks, the increase in money and spending boosts business sales revenues, and since the expenditures that constitute the costs were made in the past and are not retroactively affected, what's the effect of the additional spending on nominal profits?
Increase.
They're increased. So the war or any increase in government spending adds to nominal profits. And it does this at the same time that the additional money in spending is raising prices. So now, many people see, here we are, we have to pay much higher prices, which we can't afford. Our incomes have not risen, or not risen as much. And we're being hurt by the higher prices. And who appears to be benefiting?
Business.
the business firms appear to be benefiting, unless they have much higher profits. And then on the basis of large numbers of people financially suffering because they can't afford the higher prices, and businesses apparently being more profitable than ever, well, that combination easily leads to imposing price controls. Now, we need to step back here and look at the issue of profits more closely. It is true that the expansion in money and spending does increase business profits, but it's nominal profits that are increased. Profits simply in terms of current dollars, and not at all necessarily real profits, not necessarily real gains. And I want to illustrate that. We'll see it in two different levels. First, we'll see it with respect to inventories. Now, let's take the simplest kind of case. Let's imagine that we have a business that spends $100 on January 1st and sells its product on December 31st of the same year. And the prevailing rate of profit is 10%. So it spends $100 January 1st, sells its goods on December 31st for $110. Its profit is 10. And let's imagine that it pays half of its profit as a tax. The tax rate is 50%, 0.5. So it pays 5 of tax. And its after-tax profit, it will therefore be 5. Now, if there is no inflation, the firm does not need to make any reserve for replacement at higher prices. The firm can replace just out of 100. The firm takes in 110. It initially paid 100. If there's no inflation, how much will be necessary to replace what it had paid 100 for? Yeah. Only 100. It won't need more than 100. And it's got that 100. It has, after paying taxes, it has 105, so the 100 covers the replacement, and the 5 represents a real gain. The firm could consume the 5, or it could expand its operations. The 5 is a genuine gain. All right, now let's introduce inflation. And here we are, once again, on January 1st, the firm spends 100. But over the course of this particular year, there's an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, so that by the end of the year, when the firm sells its goods, it's going to sell it for 10% more. We'll assume the quantity of money and volume of spending are 10% greater by the end of the year. So instead of taking in only 110, the firm takes in 121. But it still only spent the 100 January 1st. That isn't changed retroactively. All right, so what's its profit? 21 is the profit, and what tax must it pay if the rate is the same? 10.5. Now, the only problem is, how much is it going to cost to replace its merchandise? If prices are rising 10%, what will be the replacement cost of the merchandise that it bought for 100 on January 1st of year one? How much will that cost on January 1st of year two?
110.
So what this means is, if the firm wants to be able to replace its inventory, which it had initially spent 100 for, it now needs 110. So where are they going to get that extra 10? Well, they have to set it aside out of profits. The profit after tax is 1050, but they need to take 10 of that 1050 and set it aside as a reserve for replacing the inventory at a higher price. Well, what does that mean about what is left to the owners of the firm, either to consume or expand after full allowance for replacement has been made? Instead of having $5, which they used to have, they only have 50 cents. See, what's gone on here is the inflation has raised their nominal profit from 10 to 21. That's one thing that it's done. But the same inflation has also raised their replacement cost by 10%, from 100 to 110. But the taxes that the firm has to pay doesn't take into account the higher replacement cost. The taxable profit is based on your historical cost, not the higher replacement cost. So you're being taxed on 21 of profit, when in fact, if we measure the profit as beginning, only after full allowance for replacement had been made. If we restated profits, if we allowed an additional deduction for the higher cost of replacement, how would the profit appear? Suppose you said, okay, it's true, we bought this merchandise for 100, we're selling it for 121, but it's gonna cost us 110 to replace it. And suppose the government decide, okay, if you have a higher replacement cost, take the additional replacement cost and deduct it from your profit and only pay tax on what remains after that. So what would be the restated profit? And we take an additional 10 off the 21. The profit, instead of being 21, would be 11. Now, if you only paid the 50% tax on 11, okay, then you have 550. Your profit is 10% higher. Prices are 10% higher. Your profit is keeping up with the higher prices. You're not falling behind. But what's being done is the firm is being taxed on a profit which is really required to replace assets at higher prices. You need $10 of that 21 of profit to replace assets at higher prices. That's being ignored, and you're being made to pay tax on funds that are required for replacement. It's equivalent to the government saying, okay, you spent $100 for your inventory, we're taxing you $5 on the 100 that you paid for inventory. If they did that, then you'd only have the ability to replace 95 of the inventory. It's working as a tax on capital. Now, this is what's going on, but people don't see this. They see the higher profits. They think profits have never been higher. The fat cats are growing rich. The average person is suffering from higher prices, and they want the government to have more power. Now, we'll see the same thing in a moment with respect to fixed assets. Let me point out there are important relative wealth and income effects in connection with inflation. Just think, there are a lot of people on fixed incomes. There are others on incomes that are only adjusted intermittently. And what's the effect on these people of significantly rising prices? Yes?
They can afford less
than that. They can afford less. They're being seriously harmed. Now, even if you have some kind of price level adjustment, let's suppose you have some deal once a year, your income will be adjusted for the rise in prices. Well, that takes place after the fact, after you've been paying higher prices throughout the year. How do you ever make up the loss in that year? You can't. There's no way to adjust for this problem of lags and incomes slow to adjust, let alone fixed incomes. And just think of the effects on any kind of long-term contract. Suppose you're a landlord and you're you're issuing a lease to a tenant, and say it's a 10-year lease. Well, the rent paid now and maybe next year looks very good, but how is it going to look in 8 or 9 years?
It's going to look worse.
It'll be grossly inadequate. Now, there's a series of effects on saving and capital accumulation. This is point six. We've already had a glimpse a few minutes ago with the inventory case. But let's look further. I refer first of all to the reversal of safety. Now, under a gold standard, which is what many people, which everyone grew up under at one time, and which their children and even grandchildren still took for granted, I think. Under a gold standard, if you had any kind of fixed contractual obligation, like suppose you bought a bond under a gold standard, or you issued a mortgage to someone under a gold standard, and they're obligated to pay you some definite amount of money each year for some considerable number of years, wouldn't you be very reasonably entitled to take for granted the buying power of the money? You think, okay, a dollar is a dollar. This is the buying power, and I can count on the buying power of the dollar next year, 5 years from now, 10, 20 years from now. Now, in those circumstances, what would be the most sensible way for many, many people to save? Do you think it would be a good idea for the average person to invest in common stocks that he has very little knowledge of, or to invest in high-grade corporate securities, high-grade bonds? I think high-grade bonds, endowment policies with life insurance companies, because most people don't have the time and maybe not the ability either to follow the ins and outs of the developments in the different industries, among the different companies. I mean, to really be on top of that, you have to devote a lot of time and attention. You'd have to be reading the Wall Street Journal every day, other financial publications. You'd have to be examining quarterly income statements, annual balance sheets, one thing and another. And most people don't even know how to do this. And even those who do or might learn, they don't have the time. So what would be the sensible form of investment for probably most people? Bonds, endowment policies, even savings deposits at banks, if you could take the buying power of the money for granted. Well, now you can't take the buying power of the money for granted. The only thing you can take for granted is that the buying power of the money is going down. It's only a question of how far down it will go. Now, if you really start thinking about it, what does the future buying power of the dollar depend on? If you think of it in terms of the quantity theory of money and what that implies. Well, it depends on how rapidly the quantity of money will be increased. But who determines that?
The government.
It's government officials that determine how rapidly the quantity of money is increased. Now, in the first instance, you might say, okay, it's the members of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. They're determining it. But what determines who makes up the membership of the Federal Open Market Committee and the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System? The members of the Federal Reserve Board are appointed by the President and then confirmed by the Senate. And they haven't gotten there walking out fresh from birth into that job. Before you could get into such a job, you have to have made quite a few connections, and there'd be quite a few people that you have obligations to, and so you'll always be subject to extensive political pressure, and the government always wants to be in a position to have more money. Now, in order for there to be any hope or prayer of the quantity of money being increased moderately, what principle would the people in charge have to know and be seriously convinced of?
That they don't want to have a balanced budget.
Well, right? A balanced budget is out the door. But here we are, we have a group of government officials that has power to determine the rate of increase in the quantity of money. So imagine we have someone with a gun. If you have a hope of not being shot and killed, what must the person with the gun first of all have to be aware of? We'd have to be aware of what the gun can do. They'd have to be aware the gun is dangerous, that could kill people. That would be the first requirement. They'd have to know what are the effects of what he's able to do, what are the effects that that can have. Well, in order for the government officials to know the effects of what their power can result in, what principle of economics that we've spent a lot of time developing would they have to know, understand, and agree with?
Macroeconomics.
Pardon me?
Macroeconomic.
No, more specific. The quantity theory of money. They'd have to recognize that increasing the quantity of money underlies the increase in spending and the rise in prices. They'd have to be aware of the quantity theory of money. Now, but not all of them are. If you pick up the typical mainstream textbook, they may mention the quantity theory of money, but they'll say that that's one of several theories and not by any means necessarily valid. So what do you think your chances are if you're in an environment in which those in charge of increasing the quantity of money do not seriously believe in the destructive consequences that that can bring about? Is that a very happy situation to look forward to? No, but there's even more. Let's suppose they have knowledge of the quantity theory of money. They have some awareness. Then you have to hope that they will be loyal to that knowledge. You'll have to hope that they not only have knowledge, but that they also have integrity. So what does this mean about what the future buying power of people's life savings have come to depend on?
That we've got people in government that are honest and have integrity.
Yeah, but it depends in the last analysis on the knowledge, the state of knowledge, and integrity of government officials. That's what the future buying power of your life savings have come to depend on. Now, I think that's a hugely risky investment. And this is what I have in mind when I talk about the reversal of safety. The traditionally safest investments, namely bonds, insurance endowment policies, savings deposits, under a gold standard, these would be the safest investments. Under our system, in the long run, they're the least safe investments. You can count on getting the money that you can count on, perhaps more than ever. The key question is, what will be the buying power of that money? That's what you can count on. And because, yes, Mr. Drew.
I was just going to say, what would be the most immediate impact of shifting from changing the money supply to going back to a gold standard immediately? Do you think that politicians might be aware of the theory and might be like, well, I think it'll work, but I don't want to instill it when I'm in office because of the negative effects that it might have initially?
Well, that is possible. It's conceivable. It could have some serious short-run negative effects, yeah.
And do you think that's a valid concern?
Well, it has to be a concern. But things could be done to move us closer to that. You don't have to go to it all at once. But certainly the obstacles in the way of citizens accumulating gold and preparing the ground for a move back to gold, that could be facilitated. Yes, Mr. Gates.
Gold standards only work though depending on how much gold that you that the nation holds, and we don't hold that very much gold.
Well, the U.S. government has the largest gold reserves of any country, by far.
So they clearly see value.
Pardon me?
They clearly see value.
They clearly see value in holding.
Contrary to their economic policy.
Well, the U.S. government does, but the central banks of many other countries, including Britain, even Switzerland and Australia, they've greatly reduced their gold holdings.
To whom?
It's now spread around the world in the hands of numerous private individuals.
And they're banking on us.
Well, they think, you see, their attitude was, they don't earn any interest on their gold reserves. And they think there's no reason to hold something that doesn't earn any interest. And they think that the price of gold is never going to rise. Now, it turned out many of them sold their gold. They drove it down to a price of close to $240 or $260 for a while. and now it's been well over 400. But yes, Mr. Drew.
I was just going to ask you a question on an unrelated matter.
Yeah.
I was just going to want to get your opinion or viewpoint on just education system in general in the United States on whether or not taxpayer money is appropriately used for like state-run schools, university level, or whatever.
I'll answer you in one word and then give you a reference. I would say no, but I won't attempt to discuss that here.
No,
I do have a discussion in Chapter 10. And so I would refer you to that. Okay, so hopefully you can see the risk effects of the present monetary system on the average person, and this means that if you want to provide for your future, your only option really is to invest in the stock market, where you don't really know very much what you're doing. And I think this set of circumstances contributes to the fact that people save so little nowadays, because they're aware that what they can save and count on retaining in terms of dollars is going to be of lesser buying power, so they might as well enjoy the money now, and they save less.
Don't you think that people use their investments as savings, like stocks, buying stocks?
Oh, yeah, but you see, many, many people can't invest well in the stock market, and we've had some recent powerful confirmation of that. We have millions of people in the stock market never really should have been there in the first place, but they had nowhere else to go because they can't invest in the older traditional forms. Well, that means they're going to just lose buying power. So either you have to be in the stock market or you'll simply get wiped out from a loss of buying power. And people who feel they can't succeed in the stock market, they don't know it, they don't trust it, they end up not saving or saving much less. So we've had a great reduction in the rate of personal saving, and I think a good part of the reason is the insecurity over the future buying power of money.
Well, how are we going to support these people when they get older and can't work anymore?
Government.
The government is supporting them. And that problem is getting worse because the ratio of people will be supported relative to those who will be supporting them is going to rise.
You know, it's interesting because even when you look at like 401k plans,
yeah,
and they'll put together the 401k plan and they'll provide a guidance for what your propensity for risk is, and those things that have the lowest amount of risk would be more into bonds and things of that nature, which is interesting because it's really adverse to what we're saying here. It's really not going to accumulate wealth.
Yeah. So,
but it's safer, and it is classified. I mean, even today, you look at any one of these bond or 401ks that are managed by whoever it is, Prudential, that's what they say, safe, low risk. So it's potentially.
Right. Yeah, that's how it is. Yeah. All right, well, let me jump ahead. One thing I wanted to be sure to cover is more on tax effects. We looked at the inventory case a few minutes ago. Let's look at depreciation now. And here we are. Let's assume we have a machine or any other form of fixed capital which initially costs $1 million, and we'll assume it lasts for 10 years. So straight line depreciation would be $100,000 a year. And we'll look at it without inflation and with inflation. And imagine that the sales revenues of the firm using this machine, its annual sales revenues, are $1 million. Its operating costs are $850,000. So its gross profit is $150,000. And then there's the depreciation cost. That's $100,000. And the net profit before tax is therefore $50,000. We'll assume it pays a 50% tax rate. So that's $25,000. Its net profit after tax is $25,000. Now, if there's no inflation, when this machine needs to be replaced, $1 million should be sufficient. And the firm will accumulate $1 million by setting aside $100,000 per year of depreciation. So it's made adequate allowance for replacement, but it doesn't need, it has no need for a reserve for replacement at higher prices. So it's profit of $25,000 is available for consumption or expansion. They could pay a dividend that great, and they've still covered their replacement needs. And I assume they pay a dividend of $10,000, and they reinvest $15,000. So the firm can actually grow. All right, now let's look at the exact same situation with inflation. We assume that while the firm is still using this same machine over the course of its life, inflation brings about a doubling of its sales revenues. We'll assume it also doubles its operating costs. So its gross profit has doubled, $300,000 instead of $150,000. But notice, what is still the depreciation on that machine which it bought for $1 million? It's still $100,000. Now, what's happened to the firm's net profit before tax? It's now $200,000, and this looks wonderful. It looks like the profit has quadrupled. Who could ask for a better result? Okay, what's going to happen to the firm's tax payment at the 50% rate? Okay, that goes that quadruples too. The net profit after tax is $100,000. That's still quadruple what it was. There's only one huge fly in the ointment, and that is, how much is it going to cost to replace this machine? Well, if inflation has doubled, if inflation has doubled everything, it should cost $2 million to replace the machine. But how much depreciation will they have accumulated? $100,000 a year for 10 years, only $1 million. They'll be $1 million short. They have this extra $100,000. They have $100,000 of profit, supposedly. If they want to replace, what do they have to do with this whole $100,000?
They have to save it aside.
They have to set it aside. So I introduced the item, a necessary reserve for replacement at higher prices, $100,000. They would really need $100,000 a year extra for 10 years in order to replace the machine. If they do set aside that $100,000, then how much is available for consumption by the owners or expansion by the firm? Nothing at all. And if they continue to pay a dividend of $10,000, that dividend is at the expense of reinvested earnings in real terms. So notice, it looks like the firm is doing great. It has unprecedentedly higher profits. But the great bulk of those profits, in this case all of the profits, is required to replace assets at higher prices. And they just may not have enough to replace. And I think this kind of phenomenon goes a long way to explaining the development of the Rust Belt in the United States. In the 70s, we had factory after factory that had to close. Why? Well, of course, the 70s were a period of great inflation, and the profits of these firms were high. The government was collecting taxes on these profits, even though a great bulk of the profits was required to replace assets at higher prices. Those funds weren't available. They were paid off in tax, paid over in taxes. So you just think, what would be a better accounting treatment here?
That if you only taxed before inflation. So if you looked at the 50% would have been the differential.
Suppose the government recognized the firms are going to have to pay higher replacement prices. So they should be allowed to have an additional write-off against their net profit before tax. Instead of saying the net profit before tax is $200,000 and you have to pay half of that, they should be able to move this necessary reserve for replacement at higher prices. They should be able to move this up here and take it as a deduction from the net profit before tax. If they could do that, they would then state their profit subject to tax not as $200,000 but only as $100,000. And then they would be able to set aside an extra $100,000 for replacement.
So you would be then paying taxes on $50,000?
You'd be paying tax on $100,000 of profit instead of $200,000.
And your taxes would be $50,000.
Yeah, the tax would be $50,000 versus $100,000. See, what happens is inflation has the effect of bringing about a staggering rise in effective tax rates. It appears there's no rise in taxes. But actually, the effective rate of tax on the real gain has risen from 50% to 100%. You see, a real profit here is not $200,000. After you have allowed for full replacement, your profit is only $100,000. And you're being made to pay $100,000 of tax, even though your gain is not $200,000, but only $100,000. You're being taxed on $200,000 when your real profit is only $100,000. Mr. Kane.
Don't they have an accounting treatment for that, LIFO?
LIFO pertains to inventory. That's last in, first out. So when you use inventory accounting,
effectively the treatment from what you're talking about.
I mean,
that possibly is a treatment from what you're talking about.
Well, I don't think we have anything like that for fixed assets. See, we do have LIFO for inventory, which means that you could take your highest cost, most recent inventory, which would tend to be the highest cost, and you treat that as your effective cost. But we do not have anything comparable for fixed assets.
But as far as determining gross profit, I'm saying before
you have to go by the historical cost of the machine. Now, there are some countries where these problems have been more severe, more protracted, where they have a different system. For example, in Brazil, they allowed you to take a greater deduction for replacement at higher prices. This will have to be the last question before we quit.
Okay. It's my understanding that inflation usually doesn't take companies by surprise. They're usually able to see it coming ahead of time, and they raise prices ahead of time in order to accommodate.
Yeah. Well, even if you try that, let's suppose our company saw this coming, and they'd have to raise their price. See, they really need an extra $100,000 for 10 years, which would mean they'd have to raise their price before the inflation occurred. Well, then what happens to the extent of their market for their product?
They would sell less.
They would sell less.